I have three be a better writer tips. The first, write. The second, read. The third, get together with other writers. That third one can be tricky, but we've got you covered. At the Writing Excuses Retreats, we offer classes, one-on-one sessions, and assorted activities to inspire, motivate, and recharge writers just like you. As you make meaningful progress on your stories, you'll build connections with your fellow writers that will last for years to come. Check out our upcoming events at writingexcuses.com/retreats.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the story of the one who, as a maintenance specialist for a historic high-rise, knows that vintage charm historically needs constant attention. Which is why, when it's time to upgrade turn-of-the-century mechanicals, they turn to Grainger. With easy access to a million-plus products and the scale to deliver when and where you need them, the right tools and supplies are never far away. So the one can keep that vintage building running like new. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This episode of Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. If you would like to learn how to support this podcast, visit www.patreon.com/writingexcuses.
Season 19, Episode 46. This is Writing Excuses.
An interview on structure with N.K. Jemisin.
I'm Howard.
I'm Dong Wan. And we are incredibly excited to have a guest with us today. As the title implies, we are interviewing N.K. Jemisin as we are finishing our section talking about the fifth season. Nora is truly one of my favorite authors working in the genre today. And I think an absolute powerhouse when it comes to sort of redefining what fantasy is right now. Not to overstate it right as we head into this. But we're incredibly excited to have you here and to start diving into some of the topics we've been talking about when it comes to the fifth season. So welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm N.K. Jemisin. Welcome. And thank you for welcoming me to this podcast. You are also the sweetest person in the world. The fact that you said that. Thank you.
Oh, very, very happy to. And I promise it's only true things. But let's dive right into it. So as we've been talking about fifth season, we've really focused on the structure of this book. And with sort of the three point of views that we've eventually realized is all one character just split across time. I was always entranced by how this book is put together. It feels like an intricate puzzle box. And yet, as we were chatting before we headed into this recording this episode, you mentioned that you don't do a lot of planning ahead of time. So what did the process look like for you to put together this thing that as a reader feels quite complex, but to you was an organic process?
There is some structure involved. I wrote a outline that sort of basically laid out the three plotline structure. Sort of opening, which would be sort of an overview of the world, just to kind of introduce people to the planet as a character. Mm-hmm. And that there would be a cliffhanger ending. All of that I knew up front. And my initial thought was that the story was going to be third person, you know, very traditional telling, present tense, I'm sorry, past tense, third person, you know, nothing sort of experimental or unusual there. But I always write test chapters. And the test chapters, I will just simply start writing, like I'm spitballing. I'm trying to see what voice feels best, what makes it flow, what makes it have the right energy. And so I will try it over and over again, in some cases from different POVs, different tones, different voices. And for some reason, I found myself drawn to this bizarre part third person, part second person, mm-hmm. present tense-y, almost, it increasingly felt like I was trying to write poetry, and I suck at poetry. So, you know, I've attempted multiple times to write poetry, only to realize I'm entirely too literal a person to do that. But, you know, here I am, I'm pulling the Hollow Man, you know, I'm pulling E.E. Cummings. I'm like, all of a sudden, all of the poetry I've ever read in my life is starting to speak to me and wants me to acknowledge that flow, that energy. And it was a purely instinctive, you know, like just this feels right. So I started writing. It started to flow well. I was like, this is bizarre. I've never really written anything this just experimental, I guess, for lack of a better description. I've never written anything this off the beaten trail. I don't know if it's right, but it feels right, so I'm going to keep going. And then, of course, you know, I hit a point about like halfway through the book where I suddenly decided that, you know, this is the worst thing I've ever written. I can't believe I've written this much. I need to stop right now. Davy Pillai, my then editor at Orbit Books, had already offered me a 3-book contract. And I had happily signed it and happily gotten the advance. And at that point, I was like, you know, I've never written anything like this. I can't keep doing this. This is gonna make people, you know, think that I'm the worst writer in the world. So I called up Davey. I was like, I want to stop doing this book. I'm going to change this back to a single book contract. You know, I think I was crying. And Davey was like, you know, the editorial equivalent of, you know, okay, Nora, have a Snickers. you know, you always want to quit your novels when you haven't eaten, you know, like, so, and basically she told me to sit the hell down and relax. And around the same time, a bunch of friends of mine, dragged me out for a intervention brunch intervention, over mimosas. They were like, Nora, have a Snickers.
Stop reading modernist poets and get back to reading your poet.
Anyway, so we are segueing away from talking about structure. I am sorry, but that was basically how it worked.
Well, but see, that's structure and process are so intimately intertwined. Mm-hmm. I mean, when we talk about structure with each other, when we talk to writers about structure, it is as part of a discussion on process. Mm. You know, you have a structure that you are originally working with, and then you realize, you get to the middle of a book, as I think almost all of us do, and decide that we're wrong. We've always been wrong. We hate writing, and we're done. And that is a structural moment. That is a moment where you go back and you look at what you're doing and you eat the Snickers and you have drinks with friends at the intervention. And then you go back and I assume at some point you realize, oh my goodness, the second person is actually teeing up a wonderful reveal. And I don't know when that moment was.
Yeah,
but that reveal was brilliant.
Well, the reveal, so I knew at the beginning that all three perspectives were the same person. That was a given. I knew that my primary perspective needed to be Essen, that Essen was the person whose story I was ultimately telling. You know, they're all Essen, but, you know, that was the focus that I wanted to keep. So, you know, I found myself seeding in hints into Essen's POV. I put hints in all three of them on purpose, because I am a evil writer and I cackle while I throw in little hints. And I'm like, see if you notice this one, you know. Yeah.
Going back on a reread, it is such a delight to pick out all those little moments of like, oh, isn't diabolical that she was giving us this. Like, I remember noticing stuff in the introduction of Essen that like leads to that understanding later. And I was just like,
those are my favorite kinds of books to read. Mm-hmm. The books where when you are really, when you enjoy the first read through enough that you're willing to go back and reread it and catch all the little stuff. And so, you know, that is, I don't expect anybody necessarily to pick up on it the first time around. But deep and close reading is something that I want readers to do with my work. It is what I love to do myself with, with good writing. And so, you know, I want to reward that with, you know, here's a blanket that she mentions in one chapter that you're not going to see again for like six chapters, but, you know, little things like that. So, but yeah, I knew from the very beginning that it was going to be all three people in the same perspective. I did write Essen's part first because I felt like I needed to know where she was going and where she was going to end up in order to write the other two. But then the other two, I kind of flipped back and forth between Demaya and,
Cyanite.
Wow. Okay. Coffee. I don't have enough in me. Sorry.
Always.
Yeah.
I was really curious about the order in which this was written because, you know, part of me was like, did she write it just sequentially, chapter one, chapter two, chapter three, alternating the perspectives? But hearing that you wrote one of the POVs first and that then enabled you to write the other two, which makes sense because Essen is like the spine of the novel in so many ways. Her story is what carries us through as we start to understand the other perspectives and the history that she's had up until this point.
Yeah, I wrote the majority of Essen first because I needed to have her lodged in my head. Then I started, you know, kind of working on the other two and inserted some earlier chapters. But, you know, I reached a point where I was basically alternating between the POVs as I wrote. It just felt better that way. And in fact, in some cases, I was deliberately, like when I was writing about Demaya, I would have just written a segment in which Essen went through some terrible hell, and I wanted to seed in a parallel to that Demaya has to go through, or that Cyanide has to go through. And I had to actually kind of stop that because it was a little too obvious. And in the revisions, I fixed it, I think. But that is how it got written.
I mean, we spent a whole episode talking about parallels in this book, right? Your use of parallelism in the different character arcs, but also over time, right? You know, starting with the child death, ending with the child death, starting, you know, you'll have one beat that then is replicated across all three stories at different points in time, which like set up so many sort of like thematic resonances. It was almost like, you know, like the magic system, you were setting up these different resonances that were coming at us from different angles, which like built to something that felt quite powerful. And when you're setting up those parallels, I mean, you were saying that once you started alternating, you saw them coming in and then you sort of shifted them around or cut back on them in edits. When you're seeding like those clues in as well that you kind of mentioned, was that planned at the beginning or did you find yourself layering that kind of stuff in later? Because I think I love that we're talking about process so much because I think these are the questions people have when they see something beautifully structured. They're like, how in hell do you do that? Because you can't think of all these things when you're outlining or when you're doing your first draft sometimes.
Right. The majority of the parallels and the hints and things like that, I seeded in from the beginning. I took out a lot. I am not a subtle person. I am a person that throws bricks at the heads of my readers. And I have to stop sometimes because I need to be more subtle than I naturally am. So revisions are my favorite. Revisions are when I'm like, oh, that's way too, you know, let's turn that brush stroke into, you know, a dab. Let's turn that brick to the head into a pebble to the head, you know, or whatever. So I removed a lot of really obvious stuff. And honestly, it still felt too obvious to me. But then I ran it through some beta readers, and that helped a lot. Because things that scream obviousness to me are far more subtle in other people's eyes, I think. So,
Yeah, it's a little bit like, I don't know if you've ever performed stage magic, but it's a little bit like being the magician and knowing, you know, which hand you palmed the coin into, or being able to see from your angle, yes, I have a fake fingertip on this finger. And it's often very difficult to step out of that point of view. You're like, man, everybody's going to see this. I can see it. It's obvious. No, nobody's going to see it. You're moving your hands fast and you've written this well. And I feel like there's an instinctive element here that sometimes we have to go back and remember, you know, when I wrote this the first time, my instinct was to do this. And I've cleaned it up in revisions and I haven't broken it. And that's the thing I think we're always afraid of, is that we'll break something in revising.
Mm-hmm. No, I have always loved revisions. Revisions are my favorite part of writing. Writing raw is actually my least favorite part. You know, I am good at that part. Like the flow, once I really kind of get into the zone, you know, if I'm listening to my characters the right way, then they are speaking and the story is writing itself, at least at a certain point. But there are two huge problems. One, I have a terrible memory. And so I will write the same themes or the same kinds of scenes or beats over and over and over again, because I don't, especially when I'm on deadline, I don't have time to go back and reread the entire book. And I forget that I put in some particular beat, and then I do it again, and then I do it again. So that sucks, because each writing session is, you know, about anywhere from like 1,500 to 3,000 words a day. And by the time I get to the point where I, you know, am doing page 100, I will have forgotten what's on page 25. So that's one problem. But the other problem is that the urge to be subtle feels coy to me. I've always preferred just being straightforward. I've always preferred just saying what I mean. The problem is that, you know, it's a good idea to be subtle sometimes. It's a good idea to kind of let the story speak for itself, the action or the setting or whatever speak for itself. And I've got to get myself out of the way of that. You know, I have, you know, sort of a, I'm told that this is a, you know, typical neurodiverse person behavior. I don't know if that's true. I'm still adjusting to realizing that I have been ADHD my whole life and had no idea until relatively recently. Yet, when I look back, I'm like, how did I not know? Anyway, but so I'm...
We've all been there.
Yeah, so I'm told that it is sort of common for folks with ADHD to just repeat themselves over and over again, trying to be more clear each time in the hopes that they can get across, you know, what they're trying to say. You know, if they're just clear enough, if they just, you know, say it slowly or carefully enough. And as a writer, I am especially prone to that because I'm like, if I just write it exactly the right way, they'll all get it and it'll be obvious. And then I won't need to do it again. And no, that's not how anybody works. So it's not how I work. I don't even know why I expect that of other people. So so I have to kind of get myself out of the way. I have to stop my urge to explain and explain and explain. And that is what revisions help me fix. So.
You know, that's it. If you're going to err on a side, I think erring on being straightforward over being coy is so powerful, right? There's so many times I read a book that is just holding so much back that I'm like, there's nothing keeping me here now. You've kept so much back that I am just straight up forward, right? And so I think the instinct of just telling the reader stuff up front, I think, does so much to keep us engaged. And then I love this idea that in edits, you're like, oh, I got to pull back a little bit. I got to hold a few things back. I'm telling them too much. But I think starting with too much and pulling back is always an easier edit than starting with, like, underwriting is harder to edit for than overwriting, right? Not to say that you're overwriting.
I'm not sure. I've never underwritten. I've always overwritten. But the overwriting is a problem in and of itself, though, because past a certain point, you know, I find underwriting coy. Overwriting is condescending. It is patronizing to your audience. It is assuming that your audience lacks the intelligence to figure out simple stuff.
Yeah.
Subtle stuff. And that's not what's in my head, but you know, that's how it feels when it comes across. And so I have to keep that in mind too.
There is
a sweet spot. Yeah. There is a sweet spot. And there is a trust factor, and you have to remember that your trust factor changes as you proceed through the book. Yeah. You start out at the very beginning, your audience does not necessarily trust you at all, especially when you're hitting them with second person and a bunch of other weirdness. Past a certain point, though, you can start to be very, very delicate with your brushstrokes.
Mm-hmm.
And I tend to still slap on the paint. But revisions are where I thin it all out.
Well,
to beat a metaphor to death. I'm sorry about that one.
No, you're doing it. It's great.
All right.
Speaking of overwriting, we have run a little bit long here, so let's go ahead and take a quick break.
Sure.
Writing doesn't have to be a solitary activity. That's why we host in-person retreats and workshops. At the Writing Excuses retreats, you'll get access to classes, one-on-one office hours, critique sessions, and activities to keep you inspired and motivated. Become a more engaging storyteller and learn how to navigate the publishing landscape. As you make meaningful progress on your stories, you'll also build connections with your fellow writers that will last for years to come. Check out our upcoming events at writingexcuses.com/retreats.
My thing of the week right now is the video game Alan Wake 2. I have gotten very into the Remedy Connected Universe, I think is what they're calling it. Alan Wake is the sequel to the game Alan Wake. It is companion to a game called Control, which won lots of awards last year. Alan Wake 2 won lots of awards. These are writer's games, I think, because they are games that are heavy into sort of exploring the artistic mindset, among other things, but also, the paranoia that revisions are for writers. Are you making the story better, or are you dragging the story to hell? And is the story dragging you to hell? Are you actually putting in, breadcrumbing your ideas thoroughly, or is an Eldritch Abomination slowly dragging your story into a terrible place? Alan Wake 2 is a game about a writer who is literally trapped in his own novel. There are other characters involved. There are other plot elements to it. As a writer writing this, playing this incredibly meta-fictional game, it has been absolutely fascinating to me to realize, how writing looks to other people, how writers look to other people. That's been a little actually intimidating, because you realize Alan's coming across to pretty much everyone that meets him as just being absolutely batshit. And there's something wrong with the guy, and everybody can see it. And I'm like, is that how we see it? Oh, good to know. But then you also see things like the author's characters getting revenge on him.
Uh-huh.
So there's a lot going on there. But it's been a delight to play. And I'm actually super excited because next week sometime the latest DLC, the Lake House, drops for it. So I cannot wait for a chance to play that.
We've been talking about doing a bonus episode talking about Alan Wake, and
really?
I think now we have to do that, and we have to have you back to do a deep dive with us
happily.
On why this game is so brilliant. Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back. So far we've done a wonderful dive into your process and how you think about the structure for these books, what that looks like as you develop it. I want to zoom out a little bit and take a little bit of a step back, because One thing I was thinking about is, and this might be, you know, my publisher perspective coming in, right? Of this book is very much marketed and sold as epic fantasy, right? It's very much fitting in that category. Mm-hmm. One of the things I think is so interesting about it is it feels very fresh and contemporary. It's not surprising to me that you were like thinking about modernists as you were writing it. There's something so much about like the rupture of technology, sort of modernity coming into this book in a certain way. And it feels very contemporary. It feels of, you know, non-genre fiction in terms of a structure. But when you look at all the elements, it's literally wizards going to a magical school, you know, with magic crystals and things like that, right? Like, especially the first book has so many of the trappings of classic fantasy brought into it. So, you know, epic fantasy can have a really rigid structural drive, right? It wants third-person omniscient. It wants prophecy. It wants multi-POV, like all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. Were you actively thinking about the category as you were conceiving and drafting this novel? Or were you just like, I'm just going to do my own thing? And did you feel a tension with that tradition at all?
I definitely felt tension with the... I always feel tension with the epic fantasy tradition. I take very much to heart your statement that epic fantasy wants certain things. Mm-hmm. And I find myself hearing those calls for certain things and saying, no, fuck you, epic fantasy. I'm not giving you what you want. But, you know, I have spent probably the bulk of my career fighting with epic fantasy because I see such potential in that subgenre. It is like, why are we fixated on, you know, medieval European epics or that as epic? Why aren't we looking at Gilgamesh? Why aren't we writing about, you know, Sundiata? Why aren't we writing about all these different cultural traditions instead of just a few? Why aren't we exploring science fictional landscapes? You know, there's no reason why you can't have magic in space, you know, and things like that. So I do not like the rigidity of any genre. I react badly when I'm told that the way to do a particular kind of genre is only XYZ. I'm like, well, what about XYA? And so that is how my head works. So yes, I very much was like, I'm going to put a lot of science fiction in this. And then somewhere in, I think, book two, well, this is a spoiler, but somewhere in book two, I gave a name to the force that is being used, and it is not orogeny, it is magic. Mm-hmm. And I'm just, you know, I just did that to screw with the audience, kind of on purpose, because I'm an evil writer, as I said.
Because at that point, the book is becoming more science fictional. It's becoming more science fiction in terms of its logics and technologies. And then that you're throwing at us like, no, this is magic. And it's such a lovely little tension there. Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's a particular thing that I was doing, which is the, I believe it's Clark's Law, is any sufficiently complex magic is indistinguishable from science fiction. No, other way around.
Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from
magic.
Thank you.
There we go. The inverse of that, I think, is the girl genius law, which is the same thing. Any sufficiently complex magic is indistinguishable from technology. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to play with that. What if we have magic so complex, so structured, still incomprehensible, still at its core, something that you cannot fully grasp, or at least not easily, and not necessarily reproducible, not necessarily, you know, all of the things that are science. But what if it's magic, but it looks and sounds and smells and tastes like science? And, you know, at what point do you start to treat it as a science? At what point is it just science? It's just got a weird name. You know, and I really just wanted to play with that. I did not want it to be a clear answer. I wanted it to be ambiguous to the end. Because, you know, again, this is a bit of a spoiler for later in the series. You know, the initial stage of the story where you realize how structured orogeny is, much, much later in the story, you find that another civilization went even further with the structure. And they got into, you know, literally the ability to do some miraculous things with it. They scienced it to death and then dragged the world with them. I really just wanted to explore that aspect of it. You know, it's magic, but can you science it too much? Mm-hmm. Is there a point where you have dragged it so far that, you know, it has a different core?
Yeah.
It's different in its nature, ultimately.
I love that.
Yeah, that was the idea.
Well, and like one thing I think about a lot is, you know, I think about Tolkien a lot, right? I love those books. I love the story. It's very meaningful to me. But the thing that always strikes me when I go back to Tolkien is how mournful it is. They're very sad. Everyone's always just singing songs about how the world used to be better, right? And I think so much of epic fantasy derives from that origin point of this, what is ultimately a restoration fantasy, right? It's we need to bring the old ways back, and the world was better before, and we live in this fallen time. And so much of what we think of as classic epic fantasy, obviously there are departures, this isn't the whole genre, but much of the core of the genre, much of its most successful elements tend to be this urge to bring something back that once was, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, if I'm had a couple cocktails and you catch me at the right moment in an expansive mode, what I will say is that I think the dominant mood of epic fantasy is nostalgia, right? I think nostalgia is the thing that drives a lot of it. That is not the fifth season. The fifth season explicitly starts with this statement of, you know, fuck restoration. Restoration doesn't work. We can't do that. It starts with the breaking of the world. I mean, you know, I just wandered off into a whole thesis statement about where fantasy is, but I'm curious, like, was that something that resonates with how you think about this book? Or, you know, was that not even in your mind as you're trying to distinguish yourself from that tension between what epic fantasy wants versus what you wanted to do?
That is always a tension in my mind. Like I said, one of the things that I have been fighting against that tradition within epic fantasy and other traditions within epic fantasy in my whole career. Epic fantasy has so much farther that it can go. And it's the adherence of so many writers to that nostalgic theme limits it. And I think that that's not necessarily a thing that they can help. I think that that is a manifestation of privilege. You want to get back to the world as it was, if the world as it was good for you. If the world as it was a shithole, you have no need to go back to what used to be. You would not want to go back to what, in fact, you're going to fight the quote unquote heroes of the story. You're going to be an anti-hero and try and move on to something different instead of returning to what was. And so, you know, a lot of my fiction tends to explore these themes because, you know, some of it, I mean, it's pretty obvious, I think, in the fifth season that I'm channeling slavery. And I wanted to explore a lot of different kinds of oppression within it. I was exploring, you know, closetedness among queer people. I was exploring disabled people who had been treated as useless at varying points. I was exploring a lot of different stuff. And I wanted to kind of touch on a sort of unified theory of all these folks for whom the old world was bad are going to see the potential in change. They may or may not pursue that potential, but they see it. And there's no reason for me to pretend that that tension isn't there. In the case of, you know, for example, in the case of Essen, I deliberately contrasted her against Alabaster. Alabaster is the reformist. Essen, for the bulk of the book, is the centrist, the status quo defender, survivor, etc. One of these people, you know, both of them see the potential for change. One of them is just simply not willing to put in the effort that's necessary to make that happen, and the suffering that would be necessary to make that happen. And the other is farther along on his particular path towards reform, basically. And I deliberately contrasted them because I wanted to show, you know, I don't believe that there is, I mentioned earlier that I think that nostalgic exploration tends to be associated with privilege. For people who are coming from marginalized identities, there's different ways of reacting to that same thing. I don't believe that there's any one way of doing it in a privileged way, and I don't believe there's any one way of doing, of reacting to oppression as a marginalized person. But I wanted to show different perspectives on, if you are seeing the world as it is and you see that it could be better, what do you do? So yeah, I guess it's the centrist versus the progressive, if you want to think about it that way.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, I was just having a conversation with, you know, a cis white male author about epic fantasy. And I kind of said something similar to what I said here about, like, me, even as a kid reading epic fantasy, feeling a sense of golden nostalgia of a thing I would never have access to. And his response was interesting because really he didn't quite have that experience when he read it. He, you know, felt more of the potential of adventure. And I was like, oh, is this just the experience of reading this while marginalized, right? Like, as a person of color, as a queer person, of like, oh, these adventures aren't for me. I will never get to be, you know, Tauron. I'll never get to be, you know, whoever major, you know, epic fantasy hero is. It's really interesting, you know, and I think part of why Fifth Season did speak to me so much was I was like, oh, this is from the perspective of deeply marginalized people who are, you know, being subject to active, awful oppression, right? And it's it's why the scene of the Guardian breaking Demaya's hand will just like live in my brain forever in the worst and best ways, you know. So, but I would love to shift away from sort of looking back a little bit at the traditions and talk about how you move forward. You know, you've written a whole nother series since then. And, you know, what lessons did you take away from the experience of writing these books? You know, obviously they came out to great acclaim. You won Hugos for every single entry in the series. You know, what did you, how did this shift how you approach writing fantasy going forward and what, and how you think about structure going forward, you know, to return to the original topic? Like, what were the lessons that you took away from this experience? So that's a very easy to answer question.
I think I have relaxed a little. I'm not as angry at the genre because I have said my piece. I like I said, I spent a long period of time kind of railing against the traditions of epic fantasy, frustrated by the potential that I saw that just seemed to be being squandered. You know, I would read, you know, I'm not going to name any particular works, but, you know, I would read an epic fantasy series and see how much more interesting it could have been if they decided not to restore the king to power. You know, if they decided, why don't we try democracy? You know, I know that like Game of Thrones kind of winked and nudged about ha, 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 democracy. We're not gonna, that's a silly idea. Why would we try that? You know, I know that there have been other engagements with that idea, and epic fantasy as a general thing has mostly kind of laughed at the concept of applying all these modernist, all these modern ways of thinking to the story. But you aren't bound by the ways that medieval people actually thought. You are writing to a modern audience. You are a modern person yourself. You cannot think like a true medieval person. So why pretend? Why let your biases about the medieval era impact how you actually write about the medieval era versus how people in the medieval era might have themselves actually thought? There's a lot of potential within the genre, and I spent a long time just kind of pushing at it and trying to say, look, we can do more. We can go here. We can go there. Let's try it. Why isn't anybody else trying this? And there were people who, there are people who are. Yeah. I don't want to pretend that I am, you know, the only writer that is doing something weird.
No, but I do think you kicked a door in. You know what I mean? Like, I think people were doing that, but I think you opened a door in a way, forcefully, in a way that made it easier for people to follow. You know,
well, and good. using the door metaphor, when Tolkien published Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. He threw open a door into something that at the time was being called romantic fantasy or fantasy romance or something. They didn't even have a word for it. And he had a goal, which was to create a sort of fictional mythos for Great Britain. And we all walked through that door. We all walked through that door and ended up with that POV. It ended up with that point of view, ended up with that perspective. And now when I think about world building, I have to kick myself a little bit and say, no, you're world building. You're building a secondary world thing. You do not have to adhere to the rules of feudalism or medievalism or Roman or bronze technology. Just do what speculative fiction does best and speculate.
That's you raise a really good point. What Tolkien did in creating that mythos, I think bunches of readers read The Lord of the Rings, saw what he did, and were and their takeaway was, we can do medieval Europe better. Their takeaway was not, we can do a mythos in whatever thing that we want to do. We can make up our own mythos in any direction that we want to spin it. And I think there's a number of reasons why that sort of lockstep thinking kicked in. I mean, obviously you want to make imitators for commercial reasons, because, you know, when you look at Lord of the Rings and you think what makes it, you know, worthy of all this money and all these movies and all this other stuff, you know, you're going to go for the most obvious imitations. I grew up in the 80s where there were Tolkien imitators every frickin' where. They literally called them the genre, the subgenre of Tolkien clones. And
I grew up on those. They were candy to me. I loved them.
I mean, they were candy too. I was like 10 years old. And then I hit 15 and I was like, I am so sick of medieval Europe once again. And, you know, I would have reached a point. I did reach a point where it was just sort of like, oh my God, how many times can they do the same shit over and over again? And I think that is probably what informs my writing as an artist is my 15-year-old. No, I'm tired of this. I think that's really what it kind of boils down to. But what Tolkien did was take something that he cared about and take it in and create a you know, riff on it. I wanted to take something I cared about and riff on it. And I don't care about the same things that a British professor who was born in South Africa and went through World War One. Yeah. You know, I don't think about the same things. I don't have the same interests. I'm not going there. Among other things, what interested me was American history, Black history. I inserted a theme from an actual thing that happened, the Margaret Garner incident at the end of the book. People have read the first book. So Sienite killing her child at the end, rather than letting her child return to slavery, is based on a true event, for those that did not know, based on the actual real life of a woman named Margaret Garner who escaped slavery with her children. Something went wrong. Slave catchers were closing in. She began to kill her children rather than let them go back into slavery. And, you know, it was one of the incidents that galvanized the abolitionist movement, because people were beginning to, you know, people were basically like, slavery is so bad that a mother would kill her own children rather than let them suffer it. You know, because at the time, the marketing for slavery on the part of the slaveholders was, oh, it's fine. You know, we treat them beautifully because, you know, they're an investment. We would never mistreat them. You know, it doesn't make any sense for us to mistreat them. You know, all that. And so that was one of the that was one of the thematic ways that people pushed back. And I wanted to insert all of that. I wanted to riff on American history. Mm-hmm. We are a country with so many sins to our name. And we are a country that cannot really function without putting someone in a position of suffering. And I wanted to think more about that, basically. So yep. I did the same thing that a old British guy did, but I did it from the perspective of a younger Black woman. Black
yeah, American. I mean, to me, it felt like his reference point was, you know, post-war Britain, and you've moved the reference point to being 21st century America, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And one thing I love about Fifth Season was, to me, on reading it, it felt so clearly to me to be, if not entirely about, at least in conversation with the experience of being Black in America, right? Mm. But nothing was mapping allegorically one-to-one. It wasn't like, oh, these are the Black people. These are the white people. These are mm-hmm. blah, 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 blah. It wasn't like mapping to specific things, but it all felt so densely and richly of the experience, right? But in part, well, I didn't know about the mm-hmm. individual event that you mentioned that you were referencing at the end, mm-hmm. Which is, you know, very powerful and very upsetting. Yeah. But yeah.
What I wanted to explore was oppression, not specifically yeah. racism, not specifically sexism, not specifically, you know, I was not exploring a specific oppression. I was not exploring a specific manifestation of mm-hmm. oppression. I read about suffragism in the UK and Australia. I read about the Aboriginal resistance to Australian colonization. I read about Maori resistance. I mean, I was reading as much as I could about how people in the world push back against colonizers and, mm-hmm. and what happens to societies that are colonized and how it warps those societies, how it warps the people in them. And I wanted to explore the themes and not the history. Mm-hmm. So that's why it doesn't map. I didn't want it to map. I didn't want it to be, this was not me trying to work through, you know, the specifics of my own life or the specifics of American mm-hmm. history. This is me working through what it is to be oppressed, period.
Yeah.
And I tried to do it in a way that paid respect to all of the marginalized people that whose histories and stories I read. I don't know that I succeed.
From my experience, you did succeed very well. I found a lot to personally identify with from where I come from. And, mm-hmm. you know, for someone who is afraid of being too obvious or, you know, worried about a kind of didacticism, I think you succeeded in creating something very specific and very subtle and very universal all at the same time.
I am fond of saying that there are books that are factual mm-hmm. and there are books that are true.
Mm.
And you wrote a true book.
Hmm. Well, thank you. Wow.
It does. Well, and I come from, you know, middle-aged white dude. You know, I do not come from any of the marginalized spaces. And I read a true story about what it meant to be marginalized, what it meant to be oppressed, what it meant to attempt to reshape the world when a marginalized person finds themselves with the power to do some reshaping. Mm-hmm. It was a true story for me. And I loved every minute of it, except for the parts where I was mad at you and crying.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I writers are evil. I am an especially evil writer. I admit it. I accept it. This is a thing that I have learned to own about myself. I do write certain scenes while cackling deep in my chest. Like I'm killing a character and I'm like, people are going to hate this.
Make us suffer. Yeah.
Yes. Your tears. I am sometimes like that. I try not to be like that, but I am in real life. I am very much, you know, I try very hard to be a nice person. You know, everybody's got their own inner bitchiness, of course, but, you know, and sometimes outer. But I try to be a nice person. I am very much a people pleaser and so forth. But in my deepest soul, I am a sadist. Mm-hmm.
And I think deeply grateful for it. So,
okay.
Nora, thank you so much for joining us. This conversation was truly wonderful, and it was a real delight to be able to dig into some of the thematic elements and structural elements of this book with you. Thank you for writing
it,
and thank you for joining us here.
Do we have some homework?
Yes. In keeping with you know, me being interested in video games lately, I've also been replaying Mass Effect, the Mass Effect series.
For your sins.
Always. and so, you know, what I would like to ask people to do is to imagine that they are in a game like Mass Effect, where they are presented with three different attitude-oriented choices. Let's call them Paragon and Renegade and Neutral. and so, you know, take your current work in progress, take your protagonist to date, if assuming that you have one, and, you know, flog them through those attitudinal flavored choices. What happens if you continue the story with your character having done the diplomatic and polite and nice thing? What happens if you have your character snap and just be super done with everything and say the stuff that they probably shouldn't say, but it's effective? What happens if your character tries to, you know, punt on either of these choices when they really needed to be giving a more strong response? And just run it in your head and see how that affects your plot structure. I don't know if that...
That's fantastic. Thank you so much. That sounds like a really delightful exercise. Okay. Nora, thank you so much again for joining us. And it was such a delight to have you here.
Thank you very much. It's been a delight to be here.
This has been Writing Excuses. You're out of excuses. Now go write.
Have you ever wanted to ask one of the Writing Excuses hosts for very specific, very you-focused help? There's an offering on the Writing Excuses Patreon that will let you do exactly that. The private instruction tier includes everything from the lower tiers, plus a quarterly one-on-one Zoom meeting with a host of your choice. You might choose, for example, to work with me on your humorous prose, engage Dong Wan's expertise on your world building, or study with Aaron to level up your game writing. Visit patreon.com/writingexcuses for more details.
Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends.
This episode of Writing Excuses was hosted by Howard Taylor and Dong Wan Song, with special guest Nora K. Jemison.
This episode was engineered by Marshall Carr Jr., mastered by Alex Jackson, and produced by Emma Reynolds. For more information, visit writingexcuses.com.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be. To be.